This is Cave Scott Allen of otico.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This is December 5th. We are still at NDC London. Now we're talking to a first-time guest, never been on the show before, Glenn Block.
Hello, John.
So, you got a new job.
I did. That's the never been on the show before. Yes. I didn't change my name, though.
Oh, good. Oh, good. So now you're at Splunk. What the heck is a Splunk?
That's a good question. Well, you know, Splunk, like Spelunk, okay. The word Spelunk, that's really where I think the derivation is. Splunk is a product company. We have a product we say that we gather operational intelligence. So what the heck does that mean?
Right.
Splunk is a, it does a couple of things. It's a data analytics platform. So it gathers data. Like one of the things that's really powerful with Splunk is you can feed logs into it. And it understands really popular log formats out of the box. That's where I think it really found its initial sweet spot. So it understands IIS. It understands Apache. So it has a bunch of different log formats that it understands. You can also stream logs into it. It has APIs. It's one of the things that attracted me about the company is that the entire product is really just a set of APIs. And we have a portal which you run or an app, and that app is really just a browser client that consumes the API. But anyway, that's just jumping around technical details.
Yeah.
But what Splunk allows you to do once that data has been indexed is then search against it. And it can index against data real time. So if it can monitor logs, for example, and then as new entries come in, they get fed directly into Splunk. And what's really nice about it, too, is it can deal with any kind of unstructured data. Like, it doesn't have to have a schema or anything like that. It does pattern matching. Like, one of the things that Splunk does really well for is if you have any kind of events that have, like, a date timestamp, it can often automatically just identify that using, like, a pattern match and then allow you to just search against that data. So some of our largest customers, GitHub uses Splunk.
Oh.
Companies like Target use Splunk. And so one of the common scenarios is IT admins tend to love Splunk because you have large numbers of servers that are out there and they're generating lots of log data.
Right.
And how do you know what's going on? So with Splunk, all that information can get aggregated in a single place, even different types of log types. And you can do searches, holistic searches across all that data and say, you know, like what was happening at this time slice across all these particular servers, or I can filter things down.
So you can say at a particular time, something's impacting your web tier and your backend service tier and stuff like that.
Exactly. And you could either be doing it historically against data that has already been captured, or you could just be monitoring real time. We have an alerting system. We have what I call good SharePoint, meaning we have a dashboard where you have reporting and charts, and you can extend that dashboard.
Right. Does that have lists? I'm just kidding. That's all I know about SharePoint.
I mean, you know, you have a dashboard experience where you have reporting and charting, and you can customize it. Now, the other thing about Splunk that's interesting is because it has all these APIs, you can just push data into it. So we have a very efficient mechanism for reading in log files, and we actually scale out so that you can have what are called forwarders. So I can have different servers where Splunk is not running that have these forwarders on them, and that I then just write my logs locally. The forwarders pick it up, and in an efficient manner, they then push that up so that Splunk can index it, so it scales out really well. But what you can also do is open endpoints on Splunk and just do like an HTTP call or TCP/IP and just feed it data that way. Hmm. And then where it's customizable is you can actually teach it to fetch data from other places. So one of the things we like to do at Splunk is when somebody joins who's new, who's like in engineering, one of the first things is go build a Splunk app, because Splunk has its own like app platform where you can deploy apps, kind of like the Eclipse marketplace. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, let's say you're running VMware in your company. There's a VMware app that you can install right into Splunk. I was just talking with David Fowler and saying, hey, you should be looking at this for like Jabber. You could imagine having a Jabber app in the App Store. And if I'm running my own instance of Jabber, I just install that from the App Store and suddenly just connect it to Jabber and I start getting real-time information from Jabber. So it is extensible on the back end in multiple languages. Mm-hmm. And that way you can just teach it to talk to other kinds of sources, either real-time So my first project, what do you think I worked on? Based on where I came from, what do you think was the first thing that I did with Splunk?
Well, it was, I'm going to guess it was a combination Meph, Node.js, and Web API.
It was none of the three. You forgot about Azure. I looked and said, what can I do? Azure has a ton of diagnostic data that's available. And it turned out when I looked at that, that there was already an app that they were building for Azure. Mm-hmm. But what they were looking at, the app that was being built was looking at storage.
Mm-hmm.
And websites has a whole bunch of diagnostic data that doesn't come into storage.
Right.
So it just writes locally to the disk, and there's an API endpoint for getting that. So I wrote a custom extension for Splunk, which hasn't been pushed out there yet, but it will be at some point, in Python. And I did it in Python so it would work cross-platform. So Splunk is an on-prem product. We have a cloud product as well, but you can imagine, like many of the companies that are running Splunk, they have all the data locally. They don't want to have to push it up to the cloud. That's just expensive, plus there's, you know, privacy concerns. So they run Splunk internally in their environments. So
if I'm a customer, I say I would like to buy some Splunk, and then I get I buy a server, or you ship me some hardware, or what happens?
Splunk's licensing model is pretty simple in the sense that it's based on how much data is ingested. We use this term ingest, mm-hmm. and what ingest relates to is indexing. Mm-hmm. So we don't care how many people do searches against the data. Think of it as almost like there's like a funnel where data is coming through. And one thing that's nice about Splunk is the data itself is not stored in Splunk. It's just an index. The index is created that says, okay, well, here I know what's in this data and how to be able to search it. And that's why we have things like the forwarders, which could run on that box and just communicate the indexed information.
Mm-hmm.
So the charging model is basically on how much data, like if you, and it's on a daily basis. So like if I pull in, say, you know, 50 gigs of data a day. Now remember, this is evented data. So don't think relational database,
mm-hmm.
think logs. But it's certainly not impossible to generate 50 gigs of data. We have customers that are generating terabytes, lots of terabytes of data. So the pricing model is based on the data that you process. But we do have a free license that gives you 500 meg a day. And we actually have an extended developer license that people can apply for that gives you 10 gigs of data a day for a period.
Wow.
And then we have a free cloud product, which is what I was telling David about, called Splunk Storm, which gives you a limit of 20 gigs per application, and then the data goes away after 30 days. But that's completely free.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't have the levels of customization than if you're running your own Splunk instance. And then we have a new product, an enterprise product that was launched recently on AWS called Splunk Cloud. And that is the full-blown version of Splunk.
Mm-hmm.
And where that would be interesting, I mean, there are some companies that have data that they're okay with uploading it to the cloud.
Right.
But imagine you're already in the cloud. Then you have the reverse problem today. It's like, well, do I have to suck that data down from the cloud into my data center to then be able to process it locally versus just keep it there? So with the Splunk offering on AWS, you know, let's say I'm running cloud servers already in AWS.
Right.
It's right there. It makes a lot of sense.
So you mentioned Azure, and with your background there, is there any kind of future offering where you would get a cloud offering in Azure as well?
I am pushing for that.
Yeah.
If I have a say in it, yes.
Yeah.
Fortunately, and I'm planning to do a blog post on it, it's really easy to install in IaaS. First off, because it works on Windows or Linux, it's really, really simple.
Mm-hmm.
You just go on the machine, RDP in, or, you know, SSH in, and mm-hmm. install it. And you just open up a couple of endpoints, and it works fine. But yes, I would love to have a service available.
Yeah, cool.
So I have a website hosted on Azure. What if I had one like the extension you wrote to pull in the diagnostic logs, and then I would get a dashboard showing me things like
so the data
errors.
Yeah, you see IIS, like you see web logs.
Yeah, yeah.
You could see the console output that your app if your app is generating to the diagnostic data.
Yeah.
You would see Git history, mm-hmm. like what files were pushed, what day. You would see when you push to an Azure website, there's a deployment script that runs that performs a bunch of steps. Like if it's a Node app, it runs NPM.
Right.
You'll see all that log data as well. And deployment scripts in CUDA are customizable. So, you know, that's especially interesting if you have your own custom steps and you want to see what they run. So it generates about 7 different types of logs. It got a little complicated recently because now Azure has moved in, and Azure websites by default, there's a bunch of data that you can log to storage. Mm-hmm. So the ideal solution to get all is going to have to do a combination of things, whereas the current solution just gets a zip file. But it's, you know, totally conceivable to do that.
And what's the process of writing one of those? There's an API.
To customize? Yeah. So we have, what I do at Splunk is I work on our developer experience. So because we're all APIs, we have SDKs. And we have SDKs in like 6 languages. And guess what? What was I working on at Azure before I left? SDKs. So we have Python, we have PHP, we have Ruby, we have JavaScript, which works client or server, .NET, and we have Java. So, yeah. So we have SDKs for that. But we also have libraries in the SDKs that you can use to extend on the server. So the thing that I described to you is what's known as in Splunk a modular input. And what a modular input is doing, instead of me pushing data into Splunk, it's teaching Splunk to be able to talk to new things. So when you install my app, you then get a data source that when you go to add it, it prompts you for your subscription ID, your certificate, and what the name of the website is. And then it actually connects through the Azure SDK to figure out where everything is and then just pull it down. So it's relatively easy. I mean, you get a programming model where there's a couple of methods that you have to implement, and then, of course, the hard part is actually implementing the methods.
Right. But that's running server-side.
It runs server-side, yeah.
So I'm just curious, how do you support all those different environments in Splunk? Like
Python. So we don't for everything right now. For modular inputs, we do support a host of languages. Okay. We basically have like a daemon. Yeah. So the reason it works is this. So a lot of Splunk has very Unix-y kind of backgrounds, right? So a lot of things you do in the Unix world are just based on streams.
Yeah.
So when you write a custom modular input, think of it as basically like an EXE that accepts things coming in through standard in and pipes out to standard out, which works really nice for streaming because, you're just using a stream. So if you're talking to a thing that's streaming data, you just pull it down. We then do put a programming model on top of that. So it's not quite that way, but essentially that's what you're writing through. So we'll just launch, we'll run, for example, if it's .NET, we're going to run, there you'll probably have a DLL. I'm not exactly familiar on what we do on the .NET side, but I know like for Python, we're going to run the Python interpreter.
Right.
Same kind of thing.
So what are some examples of things, like real world things people are watching for or monitoring for?
So it's really interesting. So one of the things that Splunk has as well, and one of our missions is about making that data that today is hidden from business decision makers available to them. So you'll notice when you go into the Splunk product, there's a portal where you can create reports and charts. And traditionally, a lot of that was still based on the log information. We have a query language, so you can issue queries, but you have to really know the structure of the logs. So we came out with a really cool feature recently in the last quarter called data models. And data models is like a DSL that allows a domain expert who understands the data to then define kind of a domain level abstraction that now allows a business analyst to search based on the domain without having to physically know the logs. So one example we use that for is like web logs. Like you and I, we all know HTTP. We know about status codes. We know about all this stuff, right? But we don't expect a product manager or a business, analyst necessarily to have to know that. But a business analyst might care about requests that were successful. So you could model this so that they can search and say, show me successful requests, even though it's actually going to the underlying IIS or Apache logs and doing a bunch of filtering. So that's a big area for us. And then we have a pivot mechanism that allows you to like graphically pull based on that DSL to find the kind of things that you want to find. So that is one thing. So one of the places people use Splunk is for monitoring the dev lifecycle. So this is not about diagnostics or failure. It's actually about just feeding a lot of information through Splunk about things getting pushed, getting committed GitHub, deploying to test environments, results of tests, CI, because it just has it's a really good data mining tool. So that is one place we see. The most common one is we have like the IT pro and admins that are monitoring all of their logs. Security auditing is another huge one. Just to give you a sense of like our adoption, 50% of the Fortune 100 companies are using Splunk. So it's got pretty serious usage. things like data models are really opening up using Splunk for like forecasting, trend analysis, mm-hmm. not just about, hey, my servers are failing, but being able to really take that data and make business insight decisions based on what is being captured. So that kind of covers the range of it. Just to give you an example, one of my, have you heard of Firebase? Firebase is like a database that is kind of hosted in the cloud, and it's a real-time database. And so they have a feed of bus information for San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So one of my coworkers, his name is Dennis, he built an app in Splunk that uses a map, and it visualizes real-time busing data. And this is an extension to Splunk, which is using the mechanism I just described to you, to run a node app that uses Firebase, talks to Firebase, gets the events from Firebase down, and streams them back. And then you see visualizations on the map of what is going on.
Wow.
So you can put your head there and imagine. I mean, there's a lot of rich things you can do with data, and it doesn't just have to be related to kind of things going wrong. Mm-hmm. But I would say that because things going wrong is a really big problem, it's definitely one of the places that Splunk is really attractive.
It's funny how, given this kind of analytics and stuff, you're in real time, you're almost blurring the lines between logs and like event sourcing, kind of.
Well, that's why when we really describe it, we don't describe it as a log platform. Logs happens to be a really good use case, but anything that's evented, mm-hmm. we've hooked Splunk up to the Twitter pipe. And we have a sample app that lets you do that, but most people don't have access to the phone pipe. But let's say you want to analyze and see what's trending, what are people talking about. Mm-hmm. That's all information that is buried. And it does have a very CQRS-y feel to it. It's not an event store in the same sense, but the idea of CQRS is, hey, you're capturing all this eventing, mm-hmm. so you can go back and query for things that you didn't know about or weren't prepared to do. Mm-hmm. And that is definitely there because, hey, you've gathered all this information and you can just search against it, aggregate against it, et cetera.
Right. So you mentioned Python and its cross-platform. Can you talk at all about like what technology stacks it runs? You know, like is this Hadoop or something?
No. So a great question. Is it Hadoop? So the big difference between
Are you just selling me Hadoop?
No. It is not Hadoop. Hadoop is about HDFS and file system, and Hadoop is really good. Hadoop, people generally don't use it for real time. Mm. Hadoop is generating MapReduce jobs against these gigantic logs of information. We do MapReduce in terms of that type of algorithm. We have a product, though, a special product, you'll snicker, called Hunk. And Hunk is Splunk for Hadoop. Okay. So what Hunk is saying is your data is all in HDFS, and you know you need a way to get access to it and query it. Mm-hmm. So that is what Hunk is. And Hunk launched about 2 quarters ago. Mm-hmm. But in general, the flexibility that Splunk offers is the data can be anywhere. It's where, you know, so that's kind of the difference between it and Hadoop. And it does really well for real time.
Okay, so custom, like C and then custom data storage?
Oh, so how is Splunk itself implemented?
Yeah,
I believe
it's
all C++.
Okay.
Yeah, we may run these. I mean, we have different components. Mm-hmm. We use Node in Splunk. We use it for a very specific purpose. When you generate your results to a PDF, mm-hmm. we actually use Node on the server. We have a good library that we found. And I think that's the only place we use Node right now
on
the server. You can extend, like the example I gave you, and use Node. But in terms of what we use internally, it's basically C++. And we have a front-end UI, which I think the front-end web app, I believe, is written in Python.
Okay.
So we've taken a big investment in Django. Mm-hmm. So one of the things we have, that's a good segue, is, so I was telling you how you can build these apps in Splunk, and we recently rolled out this new thing called an app framework. And what the app framework is it provides a bunch of libraries, it uses Django, mm-hmm. and it gives you a bunch of client-side libraries that make it really easy to build an app that will be hosted within Splunk itself. So that's kind of the range of technologies we use. There's no database, by the way. Because we create indexes, which are these binary files.
Right.
And all of the Splunk settings themselves are just literally persisted into text configuration files.
Huh.
Which is a very Unix-y.
Yeah.
It works.
Yeah.
But we are looking at adding a more stateful mechanism because people that are building apps and stuff have transient kind of data that they need to store somewhere. Mm-hmm. And config files are not always the way to do that. So that is something we're evaluating.
Cool. So we've been asking people just general, what are you up to? What do you do in your free time? Any hobbies, books, whatever?
So I am just in the final throes of finishing authoring a book or co-authoring a book.
That's right. Yeah, yes. Congrats on that.
Thanks. Thanks. So that has been absorbing most of my personal time when I'm not working or tweeting.
It is
called Designing Evolvable Web APIs with ASP.NET.
So just before,
and I think we're one of the only books that uses the word evolvable that's not like related to like Darwinian.
Just before you, we talked to Scott Guthrie, and he mentioned that was one of the books he was reading, and he liked it. So.
Cool. Yeah, no, I think it's been an interesting ride, but one of the angles I think that's different about our book is it's not just kind of a technology book. Mm-hmm. There's an overarching angle of, hey, you're trying to build a maintainable API, and you've heard about things like hypermedia.
Right.
And what does this all mean? And what we've tried to do with this book is to make it real. Like, here is a real system that is using hypermedia. Here is how, if you were building with web API, one way to do it. Not the only way, but one way that works end-to-end and that still lets you leverage things like content negotiation and like, for example,
so like header based versioning or is that like the when I think of evolving an API, the first question I think of is, do you do /v2/v3? Yeah. Or do you do headers, or what do you do?
I mean, this is of course a big religious debate.
Yes.
But our argument about making an evolvable system is a system that can support additional media types.
Right.
Like we're supporting collection plus JSON, mm-hmm. and a new media type, which we're actually thinking of publishing, called issue plus JSON, which are two different ways to get information, both useful, both have their benefits, and making those be able to live side by side and add new ones. That's one aspect. The other aspect is hypermedia, because hypermedia allows, you know, it's just links, really. Mm-hmm. And of course, we could have a whole show on that.
Right.
And we've probably gone way over our 10 minutes. But... hey, I'm Glenn Block. But what hypermedia allows is that you can tailor responses and offer up specific links, and it the evolvability aspect is because clients are decoupled from knowing how to build up URLs and hard coding against those URLs. Mm-hmm. They look for links that they can find based on a rel, which is like a tag,
right.
And then, you know, and new links may show up, and the clients just ignore those. Mm-hmm. And so you get evolvability on the server, because if you want to change your server configuration, the client is not coupled to how your URIs are looking. You can change them. Mm-hmm. But also that ability to tailor based on what you know about the client, which links they get back. And because you have a client that is designed based on following those links, mm-hmm. that creates a huge amount of decoupling that allows evolvability.
So I'm going to try and do something impossible, which is ask a further question on that and not make it turn into a 3-hour discussion. But because when we've talked to people before about hypermedia, it theoretically sounds incredible. But the problem is that you're talking kind of about these hypothetical clients that follow links. But people don't want that. They write these hard-coded things.
My question.
Sure.
Oh, you're stealing my question.
No.
Well, so one of the things to make clear is that link following is not equivalent to an automaton.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean there's no level of expectation on the client.
Right.
It just means that instead of the client having an expectation that it builds up these URLs,
uh-huh.
it expects to look for specific links. There are people in kind of the REST hypermedia community,
mm-hmm.
I actually try not to use the word REST anymore, hypermedia community,
yeah.
that think of like, you know, the computer, take me here, you know, like
it can just automatically
find the links and say, ooh, there's something new that's interesting, I'll go explore that.
It does sound like the information's there.
It does sound like the technology's not there to enable that. But where the evolvability comes is I can add a V2 client that has awareness of other links that it was hard-coded for.
Okay.
Yet the V1 client just functions side by side.
Okay.
That's really where the evolvability is. It's not about magical clients with pixie dust that somehow. So does that make sense?
Yeah, and again, this comes from, it's harder to evolve things if you're thinking RPC style.
Yes.
But if you're moving to resources, it's easier to add.
Exactly. And there is, you know, I'm not saying there's no hard coding. It's just that the hard coding is not based on URLs.
Mm-hmm.
The hard coding is like, is this thing available?
Right.
And if it's available, I know I can follow it and I know what it means. And if there's other stuff that's available that I don't know about, I just ignore it. And guess what? The web, and you know this because you built your, the web was actually built this way. That's how HTTP 1.0 and 1.1 both mm-hmm. were managed to get introduced, because clients and servers ignore the things they don't know.
Right.
And so they operate.
You know, it's in a funny way, this almost reminds me of the same, this is the same answer that I've gotten to moving from relational to NoSQL. Right? It's like you look, if something's not there, you gracefully, it's exactly. Okay, it's not there, you know?
One thing that's exciting, though, is finally we're starting to see more traction around hypermedia APIs. I did a talk at CodeMania about a year ago where PayPal, which is a big player, rolled out a hypermedia-based API for payments. And they, I can honestly say, had one of the worst APIs I've ever seen in history before. And they rolled out an API that allows you to now, like, the server is feeding you the links and you know what to look for. GitHub has a hypermedia-ish API. And Amazon just rolled out a big one. Amazon just rolled out a new streaming API that is based on HAL, which is the hypermedia application language, which is a media type specifically designed for APIs that are using hypermedia. So we're really seeing, and NPR just gave a talk at Node Summit about a huge media API that they built using hypermedia. So it is starting to really move out of the pure theory into real. Yeah. And that's where I think the book is going to be interesting, because it's going to say to you, hey, if you really are... And the book doesn't try to convince you this is the right way. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're very clear on that. The book just says, hey, this is what this is about, and this is what the benefits are, and this is how you can achieve it. And your mileage may vary.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that will be a great read for a lot of people who have struggled over the years with these discussions that have been so theoretical.
Yeah,
and we've been guilty of that too, right? Because I've been one of the people promoting it, and then people will be like, oh, but I don't need that, and that sounds great. And
well, this is a penance for your sins.
And on that note, we should probably wrap up.
Absolutely. So, cool.
Thanks a bunch for your
time. Hey, it was great to be here. I hope I'll be on the show again in the future.
Yeah, maybe. We'll think about it. Okay.